Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Okay, now today we are talking about vaccines, and we're talking about the attack on science, kind of, the way people are. And joining us is Dr. David Gorski. Thank you for being here, David.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
David, what's your view on the way society is kind of reacting to science now and vaccines and all this?
First off, the vast majority of people are still pro-vaccine. However, thanks to social media and the internet, a small fringe group of anti-vaccine activists sound and appear a lot louder and larger than they actually are.
Is that a problem, do you think? Because when you get a vaccine, it's not just you you're protecting other people, and you have to have a very high minimum number of people getting the vaccine for it to be effective collectively. So do you think, even though there's that small number of people who are vaccine resistors, they're causing a bigger problem than just them, right?
In some areas that's certainly true, because I like to distinguish between anti-vaccine and vaccine hesitant. Now, the vaccine hesitant are parents who are concerned and maybe doubtful about vaccines, or maybe fearful about vaccines. They're not anti-vaccine, but they're worried, and in some cases worried enough to, refuse vaccines. The anti-vaccine, people who are anti-vaccine are the hardcore. They're like, they're the ones who are spreading the misinformation that contributes to vaccine hesitancy. So I like to say, that the anti-vaxxers take the spark of vaccine hesitancy, a spark of fear that some parents have, and do their best to fan it into a roaring flame. And unfortunately, they can be successful at that.
So what are the consequences of this? I guess we've seen diseases coming back that were once, thought to be cured, but isn't it much bigger than just that?
Well, I mean, there's certainly that. I mean, you know, measles is kind of the canary in the coal mine because it is, you know, one of the most easily transmissible diseases that we know of. I forget where I read this somewhere, but, you know, if you're not immune and walk into a room with someone who has the measles, your chances of acquiring the measles are something like 90% because it's just that contagious. So it's, you know, there's a reason that the measles is the disease that we see coming back first, you know, and most prominently. But it's not just the measles, obviously. You know, any vaccine preventable disease that's contagious, you know, we're at risk of seeing resurgences when vaccine uptake falls below a certain level.
So what about the flu vaccine? I mean, this is one, and I'll admit to this, you know, some number of years ago, you know, maybe a decade, I was all into the X-Files, and I thought, you know, this whole flu vaccine, they're going to inject me with some sort of alien DNA or something dumb like that, and I never got the flu vaccine. But once I got the flu, I mean, that was it. I started getting the vaccine every time, and I've been flu-free.
The flu, well, obviously the flu vaccine is not one of our better vaccines for the simple reason that, you know, the strains of the flu that are circulating every year change, you know, and it's basically how good of a match we have between the vaccine and the flu strains that are circulating depends on how good the educated guess is that, you know, our health officials make every year as to which flu strains will be the ones that circulate during a given flu season. That being said, it's a common misconception about the flu that it's not a serious disease because people will call any sort of flu-like illness, even, and many of them are mild, that are not the flu, they'll call it the flu. You know, the real flu, when you get it, you know. You know, it knocks you on your posterior for a week or more, you know, or more, and you are sick as a dog. You know, the last time I had the flu was like 12 years ago. And again, it was like I had just changed jobs and for some reason I didn't get the flu vaccine that year. And lucky me, like within a couple of weeks of starting my new job, I managed to land the flu. It's, you know, and now it's like, you know, yes, I'm required to get the flu vaccine every year because I'm a physician and the cancer center that I work at quite properly requires it. But it's like ever since then, I'm like, okay, when are they going to start giving out the free flu vaccines? You know, because it's like, you know, when are they going to have the employee flu vaccine day?
Yeah, we get that too on my campus. It always shocks me because so many students, I mean, I see exactly what you're saying, is that students, anytime they get any sniffle, they'll say they have the flu so they can get out of class. And I think it does give them the wrong impression that, you know, any sort of cold is the flu.
Right. I mean, what they really have is probably a cold, you know.
Yeah. It's like and then what this leads to is, oh, well, I don't need to get that vaccine because it's not that bad. I was reading in NBC reported this yesterday that there was a family where, and I'll try to get all the details.
I think I know what you're talking about. I just heard about it. I don't know very much about it, which is why I don't feel like I can really comment on it. But I did hear about this story.
Yeah, I'll just mention it very briefly for listeners. And it's that there was a mother of a few kids, and the kids had gotten the flu, and one of the kids eventually died. She had taken the kid to the doctor. It was running a high fever. And the doctor prescribed Theraflu, but she didn't want to take it or administer it to the kids. She asked the Facebook group, the anti-vax Facebook group, what to do. And the advice that was coming back into her was to give them elderberry and put potatoes in their socks or something like that. And unfortunately, you know, you have tragedy strike. But this happens, you know, over and over again. I mean, do you see these sorts of things?
Well, you know, as far, you know, unfortunately, you know, given my hobby of, you know, writing about this sort of thing, I see these sorts of stories all the time. I mean, we see, you know, very unfortunate. People don't seem to understand that the flu can indeed lead to death. You know, I mean, it's not the, they'll try to obfuscate. They'll say, oh, you died of pneumonia. Yeah, because you got the flu and it weakened your lungs defenses and you got pneumonia. You know, it's, most people who die of the flu don't die of the flu itself. They die of complications or or pulmonary complications from the flu, usually pneumonia. So it's, I hear this rationalization all the time.
So do you see this same thing? Because I have had colleagues who will say, well, I think my kids, should get measles because it's healthy for them and it will help their immune system.
Yeah, of course. I hear this all the time. You may have heard of pox parties, right? Where the parents actually try to intentionally, infect their kids by snot covered whatever from a kid who has the disease. The thing is, with the measles, at least, it's exactly the opposite. The measles does not help your immune system. The measles hurts your immune system. There's good evidence coming out from recent studies going back a while, and there was a recent one that confirmed this, that having the measles causes what's something called immune amnesia, which basically leads the immune system to, quote unquote, forget a lot of the things that it's been exposed to, and you have to be re-exposed to those things in order to acquire immunity to them again. And in fact, there's good evidence that having the measles results in a higher mortality from other infectious diseases during about a 3-year period, at least, after having had the measles. So the measles does not actually make your immune system stronger. If anything, it makes it weaker for several years. It's kind of a really infuriating it's not just an anti-vaccine myth, because there are a lot of people who may not be anti-vaccine who kind of believe that getting the quote unquote natural disease is better than being vaccinated against it. The thing I like to say is, yes, you can get lifelong immunity from the measles by having the measles, but you have to get the measles, and there are the risks of the measles. Roughly 1 or 2 out of 1,000 will die of the measles in a developed country. As we saw in Samoa, in underdeveloped countries, it can be much higher than that. There's the chance of encephalopathy. There's the chance of subacute sclerosis, pan encephalitis, which is a horrible complication of the measles that happens several years after the measles that's uniformly fatal. So, sure, you can get your lifelong immunity from the measles, but you have to have the measles and take all the risks that go along with it, and also, the disease itself.
So one thing that I see now is not just a resistance by some people to wanting to get vaccines for, diseases that have been around for a long time, like measles. Mm-hmm. But every time there's a new disease that pops up, people immediately jump to, they're going to try to stick us with some sort of, corporate vaccine that's going to kill us or poison us or something like that. And we saw that with Zika a couple years ago, where people were already spreading misinformation about the Zika vaccine before such a vaccine had even been created.
Right.
And now we start to see that same stuff with the coronavirus.
Yeah, this is an old anti-vaccine conspiracy theory that goes on. That's every time there's an outbreak of a new disease. I wasn't paying attention at the time, because this was before I really got into studying and writing about the anti-vaccine movement, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if the same sorts of conspiracy theories were going around when SARS was around, you know, 17, 18 years ago. It's, you know, anytime there's a new disease that, you know, that's a threat that leads to, you know, scientists trying to come up with a vaccine for it because we want to stop its spread. This is, the, you know, you get the conspiracy theory that, oh, the disease, it's one of two conspiracy theories. One is they're just using that disease as an excuse to push more vaccines. The other one is that they claim that the disease is man-made or being spread intentionally in order to sell vaccine, you know, to sell a vaccine or, you know, to give an excuse to create a vaccine and a new, you know, profit center for big pharma.
So what do you think now? I mean, have you been watching how people have reacted to the outbreak of the coronavirus and sort of all
well,
the...
Well, yeah, the biggest, there are a couple of favorite anti-vaccine theories, conspiracy theories out there right now. One is that this is an attempt at a coronavirus vaccine gone bad or gone wrong based on you may have seen this one, a guy by the name of James Lyons Weiler claims to have found sequence similarity between an insert in this particular new strain of the coronavirus and a plasmid called P shuttle, a vector. It's a very silly conspiracy theory because it's really not that tight of a it's not a very good match for one thing. For another thing, a match with a commercially available vector doesn't, you know, if it were truly a strain, you know, if it were truly a strain of virus made to make a vaccine, the match should not be like 68%. It should be close to 100%. So, but in any case, the idea is, oh, it's a vaccine strain of virus that mutated and went bad and got much more virulent, or Chinese scientists supposedly were trying to make a more virulent strain to make a vaccine against. It's nonsense. It's kind of embarrassing that this guy actually did run a bioinformatics core at one point in his career. But he's devolved into a total anti-vaccine crank, in my opinion. The other one that I saw that was somewhat clever, but is that it's actually the flu vaccine that led to coronavirus. There's a phenomenon called viral interference. I don't know if you've heard of it, where in, you know, infection by one virus due to some sort of non-specific immune effect makes infection by another virus less likely. So here's the conspiracy theory that I saw. Basically, some anti-vaxxer somewhere noted an article in the English language Chinese press that China had bought twice as much flu vaccine this year compared to previous years. And he was saying, well, because so many more Chinese are getting vaccinated against the flu vaccine, that left them open to coronavirus because it normally the flu vaccine would interfere with coronavirus infection. The problem, of course, is one, when I looked at it, the actual number of doses of vaccine was still small compared to the Chinese population. Two, they don't really demonstrate that twice as many people vaccinated. Three, there's not really any good evidence that the flu virus, you know, interferes much, if at all, with the coronavirus, much less the strain of coronavirus that's come out of China. So, but it makes for a good conspiracy theory.
I remember when Zika was the big thing here, and I started polling on that
just a few years ago.
Yeah, and it became a big thing here in South Florida because of mosquitoes and because we're the gateway to Latin America, where there were a lot more cases of it. But when we polled on it, we were finding 20% of Americans believed in one conspiracy or another about Zika, and some of the people were saying that, you know, vaccines caused Zika, or that GMOs caused Zika.
I had not heard that vaccines caused Zika, but it doesn't surprise. How did I miss that one? Because I actually did write about a couple of Zika conspiracy theories back when Zika was a thing.
So this is the interesting thing, is if you put these theories down in a survey and you say, you know, which of these do you think are more likely true, you will have a lot of people who maybe not have communicated it before, but will say, oh, vaccines, yeah, that probably caused it, and they'll wind up picking those, even though they won't be, you know, floating around through the social media.
I always like to say that, you know, anti-vaccine beliefs are basically founded on conspiracy theories, because in order to believe that vaccines cause so much harm, you basically have to believe what I like to call the central conspiracy theory of the anti-vaccine movement, which is that, quote unquote, they know, the they being, you know, the CDC, the government, big pharma, the medical, doctors, the medical industry. They know that vaccines cause all these horrible things, but are covering up the evidence for it. You know, that's basically what I like to call the central conspiracy theory of the anti-vaccine movement. And so, it comes in all sorts of flavors. There's like all sorts of variants of it. But if you boil them down, these conspiracy theories down to their essences, that's basically it.
I heard, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, that the coronavirus is bad, but all these people who are freaking out about it, many of them aren't getting their flu shots, and they're actually at more risk from the flu than they probably are from coronavirus.
I don't know if that's true, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, there have been a number of, I've already seen at least a couple articles pointing out that, you know, in the U.S., at least, the flu is a way bigger threat than coronavirus, which is really only a handful of Americans have been, you know, infected by it so far, as I recall. If you're in China, the calculation would be different, but here in the U.S.
So we're in the depths of flu season right now. It always shocks me. Like, I wish that I could force my students to get the flu, because I'm teaching a 250 person class on conspiracy theories. My guess is a lot of the students in it are believers, I imagine there's quite a few anti-vaxxers. So I'm concerned about there being disease spread.
The thing about conspiracy theories is, all of us believe in them to some extent at one time or another. It's just how much. I mean, for instance, the whole fiasco in Iowa with the Democratic the Democratic caucuses. How many people who are normally otherwise seem irrational, but seems, you know, odd, you know, and start thinking there must be something more there. It's unfortunately a very natural human tendency to look for explanations of things, you know, that, and sometimes in looking for explanations, you know, we may, you know, make correlations or connections that, you know, we're quick to make connections or correlations that are not really there or that are very tenuous. The difference between a skeptic and everyone else is that we skeptics try to question these connections, you know, and then if you look at but it's very natural for human beings, and since you're teaching a course on conspiracy theories, I'm assuming you know this, like it's very natural for human beings to make up conspiracy theories, you know, just about everything. And the, you know, the problem, of course, is that, you know, a lot of these, a lot of these conspiracy theories have real world consequences, such as anti-vaccine conspiracy theories.
Now, you've looked into more than just vaccines. You've looked into,
mm-hmm.
you know, other sorts of pseudoscience that's been pushed by the mainstream media. Like, what's some of the pseudoscience that maybe upsets you or gets in your craw the most?
Oh, you know, obviously it's got to be, given that I'm a cancer surgeon, it's cancer quackery. I've been covering that for a long time. You know, various claims of, you know, natural healing, various treatments that are, you know, have no evidence that they work, but are often sold sometimes in these very luxurious clinics, most of which are not in the U.S., but, you know, cancer quackery has got to be up there. Because I've seen, every so often I see its victims. I mean, you know, once or twice a year, we'll get a woman with breast cancer with a neglected, nasty breast cancer who went, you know, to a naturopath or a homeopath or some other, you know, alternative practitioner and didn't come to see us, you know, until it was huge, you know, eroding, you know, fungating, eroding through the skin, ulcerated, bleeding, you know, et cetera. So I see it occasionally. Thankfully, not that often, but I do see it.
I'll chime in on that just for a second, because my wife was diagnosed 2.5 years ago now with cancer, and we were apart at the time. I was teaching in London, and she was at home. And you know, the first thing that a person does when they get diagnosed with cancer is, you know, Google it.
Yep.
So the stuff that came up was, you know, tape. I think some of the sites she was finding on the first search page were like, tape garlic and onions to your feet and that will cure it. Or if you eat lots of turmeric, it will cure it. And luckily for her, she's married to a person who can read Google Scholar and can go in and look at the actual studies and see what, you know, survival rates are, and that no, turmeric probably doesn't cure cancer. And because I'm a professor, she was able to go to the, you know, very good Sylvester Cancer Center here at University of Miami and is cured and a year free. But a lot of people make that mistake where they're afraid and they say,
right.
Oh, why would I get chemo when I can just do onions?
Well, let me give you the most common reason. You know, so you'll frequently hear what I like to call alternative cancer cure testimonials. You know, someone says that alternative medicine cured them of their cancer. Here's the most common type of these. And I like to always ask, did this person have surgery for the cancer? So for like breast cancer, did this person actually undergo surgery for the breast cancer? And the answer is almost always yes. So what then they say, but I don't want to have chemotherapy or radiation. I'll do this. I'll do mistletoe extract, or I'll do whatever. Well, in that case, the surgery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Did cure the cancer. You know, the treatment for breast cancer, for instance, is surgical. What you're doing by foregoing the adjuvant therapies, you know, the chemotherapy and the radiation, is you're just greatly increasing the chance that the cancer will come back. And you got lucky. You know, it didn't come back. The surgery was enough. But it's to people who don't understand the difference between, you know, the primary and adjuvant treatment of a cancer, these testimonials can sound convincing. I mean, there's a man by the name of Chris Wark who got colon cancer at a very young age. He was like in his 20s. And it was stage 3 colon cancer because, you know, it had gone to the lymph nodes. And he had, a partial colectomy and was recommended chemotherapy because that was the standard of care for stage 3 colon cancer. But refused it and, you know, decided to, quote unquote, go natural. And, you know, he was fortunate enough to survive. You know, it's now like 15 years later and he's fine. But he was convinced by, you know, refusing the chemotherapy and doing well that what all the other, you know, quackery that he, you know, indulged in afterwards, after his surgery, was what really cured him. And, you know, in fact, I wrote an article about him where I like went through the odds and I said, well, you know, I estimate that he basically decreased his chances of survival from like 70% to 40%. And, you know, 40% is still a decent sized number. So he got lucky, you know, mm-hmm. He survived. And he even directly addressed that, saying surgery doesn't cure anyone with stage 3 cancer. Well, yes, it does. You know, it can. Your chances are a lot, you know, before the development of multi-modality, multidisciplinary cancer care, surgery was all we had to cure colon cancer. You know, same with breast cancer. I like to say, you know, people will criticize, for instance, the radical mastectomy as a horrible operation. And yes, it was a horrible operation. But why did it come about? You know, why did Professor Halstead back in the day, you know, in the late 1800s, come up with this operation? The reason was, if you were going to cure breast cancer in the late 19th century, surgery was it. You were going to cure it with surgery. That was the only thing that had a chance of producing a long-term survival and getting rid of the cancer. And so it's not, you know, so it was not unreasonable, given what was known at the time, for a surgeon to think that more radical surgery would be more likely to save the woman's life. And in fact, Halstead's results were better than the results at the time, which is why everyone adopted the operation. The problem is we kept doing the operation decades after, you know, it was becoming apparent that less radical operations could produce the same outcomes with, you know, adjuvant care, you know, therapy. So, but the point is, you know, in the time that operation was invented or, you know, thought of, it was not an unreasonable operation, you know, because basically surgery was it. As far, if you were going to cure breast cancer, all you had was surgery. Same with colon cancer. All you had was surgery. You know, if surgery didn't take care of it, it couldn't be taken care of. Now we have all these, you know, chemotherapy and other therapies that can significantly decrease the chance of a recurrence after surgery. But they didn't have those back then.
So what do you see as some of the other big dangers right now in terms of, you know, pseudoscience leading people away from getting real cures for problems?
Well, I mean, it's not just for cancer, obviously. That's just the one I probably have dealt with the most. I mean, one thing that there's a certain area that I'm particularly, you know, that I write about on a fairly regular basis, and that's all these stem cell clinics that have popped up, you know, hundreds of them in the U.S., thousands of them if you count the world. And here's the thing. I say this and some people will take issue with it, but I have not yet found an exception. Every for-profit stem cell clinic to me, you know, is a quack clinic, you know, a predatory clinic, because unless they're treating, you know, doing standard of care, treating hematologic malignancies where, you know, you ablate the bone marrow and then use stem cell rescue, you know, it's not, you know, there's no evidence yet that these things, you know, that these treatments do what they claim, especially when they start using stem cells for everything, you know, like autism, Alzheimer's, you know, stroke, et cetera. You know, the evidence just isn't there yet. And what really bugs me about these stem cell clinics is that because there's so many of them are so shady, is that they are tarnishing, you know, they're making what could ultimately turn out to be useful treatments and potentially revolutionary treatments look like quackery, you know, because what they're doing now is quackery as far as I'm concerned. But
and the reason for that is because they just haven't they don't know for certain that what they're doing actually works, and they're just sort of making it up as they go.
Well, they're making it up as they go along. They're just like, you know, isolating, you know, mesenchymal stem cells from fat. You don't, you know, with a lot, some of these clinics, you don't even know if what they're injecting really is stem cells. You know, it's like you have no way of knowing, and they're charging tons of money. And then, you know, some of these clinics actually are doing what they claim, you know, quote unquote clinical trials and charging patients to be on them. And they put the clinical trials up on clinicaltrials.gov, you know, the website where all clinical trials must be registered. But when you look at the clinical trials, they're like phase one clinical trials, which most people don't realize that phase one clinical trials are just testing safety. And like they're looking at outcomes that are like subjective. They're not blinded, you know, so whenever you look at subjective outcomes, if the trial's not blinded, it's pretty much worthless. You know, they're basically using their clinical trials not far more for marketing than actually trying to find out if what they're doing benefits anyone.
So how about something like, and I know you've written a lot about this, acupuncture. So a lot of people swear by acupuncture, and I think there are governments and insurance companies and whatnot who, you know, recommend it as part of wellness or
for pain. The greatest triumph of pseudoscience is how many people think acupuncture is anything more than an elaborate theatrical placebo. And unfortunately, it's really, I mean, I guess I seem to recall that Medicare just agreed to pay for acupuncture if it's part of a clinical trial for back pain. If you critically look at the studies and the totality of the evidence, you're very hard pressed to come to any other conclusion than that acupuncture is basically placebo medicine. It doesn't, if you look at the studies, you see it doesn't matter where you stick the needle, which immediately tells you that all the stuff about meridians and, you know, where, you know, the channels for the flow of qi are non-existent nonsense. It doesn't even really matter if you stick the needles in, because there was a lovely trials like 10 or 12 years ago in Germany for low back pain that used as its control, its sham placebo control, twirling toothpicks against the skin. And there was no difference between the groups, although both were better than the no treatment control, which just goes to show it's placebo medicine. So acupuncture, I fear, is a battle that we're losing on, because it's just, it's not, here's the other thing about acupuncture that a lot of people don't know. You know, you'll frequently hear that acupuncture is like this ancient medicine, 2,000, 3,000 years old, you know, from China, you know. Acupuncture as it's practiced now dates back to around 1930. Acupuncture before that was pretty much indistinguishable from that old discredited European practice known as bloodletting. Old acupuncture needles used to be these big honking things that looked like lancets. And in fact, there's a interesting book by a Scottish surgeon whose name escapes me at the moment that Harriet Hall wrote about once on science-based medicine. He spent 30 years in China around the turn of the 20th century. So it was something like from 1890 to 1920 or something like that. And he described what acupuncture looked like then. And it was basically sticking hot or cold needles into various things. And he even described the case of a child who died because they stuck a needle, you know, like they stuck needles in and one of them hit like a rather large blood vessel, which means you had to stick it in pretty deep, you know, because to hit, you know, made blood vessels that if you lacerate them will end your life, you have to be sticking it in pretty deep. What else? I mean, so basically around 1930 or so was when a Chinese acupuncturist, and I'm blanking on his name, invented the fine little filiform needles that we all see now. And the reason he did that was because he wanted to apply, first he thought he was trying to shoehorn in traditional Chinese medicine ideas into like new findings in neurology. And the other reason is he wanted to be able to do acupuncture on children. And so he came up with the really fine thin needles that they use now. Another thing a lot of people don't know about traditional Chinese, not just acupuncture, but traditional Chinese medicine in general, is that a large reason for its popularity now traces directly to Chairman Mao, actually. You may have heard the whole idea Mao had was that he wanted to, quote unquote, unify Eastern and Western medicine. And in order to do that, his physician, you know, his medical his medical officials worked on taking all these disparate folk medicine traditions that were around in China at the time and trying to shoehorn them into like a unified whole, you know, basically some of it was making it up as they went along, but some of it was taking all these ideas and trying to make it sound like traditional Chinese medicine rather than a whole bunch of folk medicine traditions from all sorts of, you know, different parts of the country, you know, different populations, different ethnic groups, was actually this unified whole. And he also promoted it to the rest of the world. So for instance, you may recall there was a New York Times reporter, and I'm blanking on his name, who in the 1970s supposedly got acute appendicitis while he was in China, reporting on something. And so he was operated on, and he described how he was treated with acupuncture after his surgery and his bowels started working. You know, it was reported very like acupuncture is this miraculous treatment that took care of his pain and, you know, got him pooping again, you know, when in reality, if you look at his study critically, as one of our former writers, Kimball Atwood, did back in the early days of science-based medicine, what probably happened is he just had a post-operative ileus that resolved around the time he got the acupuncture.
For the most part, a lot of people just mistake what would be a good outcome as being caused by, you know, whatever treatment they happen to spring for at the time.
Yes, and it's not just acupuncture though, because acupuncture is just a part of traditional Chinese medicine. It's the whole thing of traditional Chinese medicine. I mean, for instance, you know, Cleveland, a lot of universities now have like traditional Chinese medicine programs, or they have, you know, quote unquote integrative medicine programs that feature traditional Chinese medicine. The Cleveland Clinic, for instance, explicitly has a traditional Chinese medicine herbologist, you know, that sells these traditional Chinese medicine things. Not all of traditional Chinese medicine is nonsense, although its underpinnings with, you know, energy flow and life energy and stuff like that are, you know, but the only parts of traditional Chinese medicine that really have any hope of being real medicine are maybe some of the herbal remedies. You know, herbs can contain real medicines. I mean, a lot of our medicines that we get a lot of our medicines now are derived from natural products. But there's nothing special in that. It's something that we've been doing forever. And in fact, what I like to say about herbal medicine is, you know, is when we take a product that's like heavily, it's mixed with all sorts of other things, and it may have, you know, unpredictable or unreliable concentrations of the active ingredient, and why not prefer the active ingredient, you know, like isolate the active ingredient, which is what we've done, you know, like getting digoxin from foxglove, for instance, or getting, you know, salicylic acid from, bark, and then finding out that if you modify it and put it in an acetyl group on it, you have aspirin and it works better. But something about the whole idea that it's natural appeals to people.
So I remember watching the Olympics a few years ago, and many of the swimmers had done what's called cupping,
mm-hmm.
where I guess it was a Chinese technique where they would sort of suck a
yes.
bruise onto their skin, and they said that this made them swim better, or it got rid of their muscle aches or something.
Right. But yeah. You basically heat up like a little glass bulb or something with this relatively small neck, and you heat that up and then put it on the skin with like a little oil so it doesn't leak any air. And then of course as it cools off, it creates suction. Yes. It's, I think Mike, was it Mike? Yeah, I think the swimmer.
I think Michael Phelps right? was using it, yeah.
He was using it, as I remember. I mean, all it does is, you know, it's like giving them a hickey, you know, basically. Yeah. It breaks some blood vessels, you know, it'll leave you with a bruise. I know athletes have a tendency to be, you know, somewhat superstitious, or they think that things help them whether they actually do or not. And maybe in a way they might be, if it, you know, mentally, if you think you're prepared to do better, maybe you actually do better. But physiologically, there's no evidence that cupping does anything other than, you know, make a bruise.
And that's particularly, that's not good for you, right? I mean, blowing up your capillaries probably doesn't, you know, probably doesn't
have a good health benefit. I mean, there is no health benefit that I'm aware of. I mean, it probably doesn't hurt you too much as long as it's not too much of your skin surface area. I mean, the claims that, you know, oh, it stimulates your lymphatic flow, or it stimulates your blood flow, or, you know, all of the stuff that's claimed for it, it's just, there's no real basis in science.
So, you know, we see so many of these pseudoscience claims in the mainstream.
Well, you know, it's popular, unfortunately, and I think there's an appeal of the whole do-it-yourself thing. You don't need no stinking doctors, you know. You can there's nothing wrong with taking control of your own health. I mean, most primary care doctors certainly would encourage that. The problem, of course, is when taking control of your own health involves embracing pseudoscience or treat things that either don't do you any good or may even do harm. And of course, a lot of that, you know, a lot of the way that various people who market this stuff sell it is, of course, by saying you're taking control of your own health. I mean, a great example of that is Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop, who basically sells a whole lot of nonsense but the marketing pitch is that they're quote unquote empowering women. And in fact, if you criticize Goop, the New York Times, which is a perfect example of this, is an op-ed, by Eliza Alberts and Jennifer Block, basically defending Goop and criticizing and attacking Goop's critics as, you know, tools of the patriarchy. You know, it's like the attack on Goop is because patriarchal medicine doesn't like women taking control of their own health. No, criticism of Goop is because it sells nonsense and pseudoscience at you know, rather high prices. You know, it's kind of funny how an already wealthy actress, you know, becomes, you know, the champion of the common woman for selling them eggs to stick up their vaginas at high prices and thus making herself even wealthier.
Wow. Well, now we are running out of time. Thank you very much for coming on, David.
Okay.
Do you have a website, or do you have a place that you recommend people go to
find out? Science-based medicine. Well, obviously, I'm the managing editor of sciencebasedmedicine.org. It's all one word. And you can find my other website by just Googling my name. But I primarily push science-based medicine. And we write about a lot of these things, and this been, you know, the block war, you know, oh man, it's hard to believe it's been 12 years now, but it's still going strong.
Well, fantastic. Well, again, our guest has been Dr. David Gorski, and thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.